This is the takeaway for Wednesday, October 18th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Glad to have you with us, and we begin today in Puerto Rico.
People's nerves are frayed after having to live in these makeshift circumstances, whether they're in the mountains and getting water from a PVC pipe, or they're here in the Capitol and they still don't have water, they still don't have electricity. And so they've got two or three or four families piled into one house, whichever person could afford a generator.
Caitlin Dickerson of the New York Times there. She's been reporting from Puerto Rico, where it's been nearly a month since Hurricane Maria hit the island. There has been progress in recovery on the outer, more developed rim of the island. On the interior, conditions are different. Food and water are short. It's forced residents to band together and help each other out.
There's very much a culture here of, I think, you know, every single person I've interviewed has said, well, but others have it worse than I do, so I don't want to complain. So there's a bit of that too, a sort of generosity of spirit that I've seen.
A lot of towns have still not seen adequate aid. In some cases, the people who live there have turned to DIY ingenuity to solve life or death problems, making use of whatever they can find. From San Juan, Caitlin Dickerson tells us what she's been seeing around the island.
I've seen really an incredible level of improvising and creativity from people who live in the mountains who don't have running water and have redirected water from higher up using PVC pipes and have created these sort of spouts that are on the sides of highways where people line up to fill up water bottles to bring home, and they use that water to flush their toilets. To a community I was told about by the U.S. military where there was a person who was diabetic living there, and the community didn't receive any aid for more than a week. And so when the U.S. military arrived, they saw that locals had created a makeshift way to refrigerate this person's insulin underwater because they didn't have any electricity and were keeping the insulin cold that way. The community redirected water, like I described earlier, but created a spout just to one person's house, a woman who was pregnant. She was 7 months pregnant and didn't have any aid for more than a week. So, and communities are really banding together. You know, when you go and visit these rural neighborhoods, they've very often chosen someone sort of unofficially to serve in a secretarial role, and that person keeps track of how much aid is received and makes sure that it's distributed evenly across neighborhoods. So it's interesting, as hard a time as people are having, I'm hearing over and over again that this storm has really brought communities across the island together.
What about infrastructure, Caitlin? What about the roads, the bridges, the ways in and out of some of the small towns and villages that you've been covering?
More than 100 bridges were damaged and 18 were completely destroyed. That includes a bridge to one neighborhood I visited in the center of the country where people had no way in or out. They've been trapped there. Their cars are stuck there. They can't go to work or go to school. And they actually created this makeshift pulley that they connected a shopping cart to and are using a shopping cart and pulling it back and forth across where this bridge once was to transfer aid back and forth. So those bridges are going to take a really long time to repair. And people there really don't know what they're going to do, how they're going to be able to start going to work or school. I mean, they can try to set up a carpool, but there are more than 100 people who live in the village. I mean, each one can't be driven to and from everywhere they need to go. Generally speaking, across the island, most roads have been cleared of debris at this point, but that means not that, you know, things look normal. That means there are huge, huge piles of debris on the sides of the road almost everywhere, which still haven't been picked up, which are starting to rot, starting to smell, and which people are worried about because they're attracting rats and other animals that can create safety risks.
We talked a lot about water and even medical supplies. What about food?
There are an incredible number of people on the island who are still surviving on these ready-to-eat military meals, these freeze-dried meals that you add water to. And people have been, like I said, in you know, surprisingly good spirits about it, but that is certainly going to get old. And it also can be hard to digest for people who aren't used to eating it. Beyond those, you know, there's more than half of the country still doesn't have electricity. And so people who had electric stoves are at a loss for cooking. I've seen people making huge batches of rice on their barbecue outside for the entire family that they sort of, you know, ration out throughout the week. Or again, you know, people coming together in neighborhoods, everybody cooking in one place with one person who has a gas stove. I visited one home yesterday where a family had dug out a gas stove that was really a family heirloom that had been sitting in a garage that hadn't been used in 40 years. They said it was filled with cockroach eggs and mold, and they cleaned that out. And the entire neighborhood has been eating food that was cooked on that stove. People are really improvising to make do and in decently good spirits about it. But as you can imagine, it's really hard to live that way.
Well, Caitlin, you're at the command center in San Juan now, and I wonder how aware the government authorities, the relief authorities, were of all these situations, all these conditions, before you put them in the paper.
It's hard to say. I mean, I think that people here know how bad it is. You know, the reality for government officials appears to be that people really underestimated the damage to infrastructure that this storm would do, right? And so as a result, in the first several weeks, there were people sort of dying immediately of storm-related injuries, far more people who lost their entire homes than they expected and were forced into shelters. And so there was a lot of time spent on sort of acute life-saving measures, you know, of making sure that people had bottled water and military ready-to-eat meals so that their lives weren't in danger. And now as you're seeing the island transition to this phase two where, okay, people have something to eat, they have water, but they have almost nothing else, you know, what comes next? I do think the response there has been slow, and that's been frustrating for a lot of people here.
Caitlin Dickerson of the New York Times has been reporting from the interior of Puerto Rico, where a do-it-yourself makeshift culture has developed to cope with the basics of life a month after Maria. Caitlin Dickerson, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
While some Puerto Ricans resort to makeshift culture to put their lives back together on the island, others have left entirely for the mainland. Joan Figueroa fled Puerto Rico on September 25th with her husband, Nadir. They're currently with family in Elmira, New York. And Joan, you've lived in Puerto Rico for 50 years, is that right?
That's right. I went there right out of school in New York City, as a matter of fact, as a Bellevue NYU nurse. Went down there to spend just a few months, met my husband, and the rest is history. 50 years. That's right.
50 years in Puerto Rico with your husband, which means leaving has to be a big decision for you and your husband, Nadir. Can you describe the aftermath of Maria and what made the two of you decide to leave?
Yes. Well, in our particular case, we're obviously an older couple at this point, living in Miramar, which is part of San Juan. And we live on the 15th floor of a condo. It happens to be the top floor. Cross ventilation, totally unable to stay there during the storm and afterward. Not a tremendous amount of damage, but with the generators very low on fuel, our elevators were down to one elevator occasionally, and then none when fuel was not available. So absolutely very, very difficult. And the heat we're experiencing at this time of year, to be going up walking 15 flights of stairs and then down again. And then when we saw the scarcity starting, we realized that this would not be a situation we should stay in.
Do you and your husband have the feeling of having fled your home, being sort of refugees in your own country, or does it feel like you're just on a long trip and staying with family?
I believe I'm having a little bit better of an adjustment than my husband. He is originally from Arecibo, Puerto Rico. He's 80 years old, and this is his home. Puerto Rico is his home, as well as it is mine, being there just over 50 years. But it really is much more difficult for him. I see him daydreaming about it. I've even heard him say, "I have a home. I have a home." Yes, we have a home, dear. We do have a home, and we will return. We just can't return right now.
Well, Joan, I wonder what you're hearing from your friends and family who might have fled like you, or even ones who are back there cleaning up, because there has to be a concern that many thousands of people now could leave Puerto Rico and not return because their homes are destroyed or their businesses are destroyed. Do you think a mass exodus is a risk here?
As you obviously know, Puerto Rico had also, due to our financial state, we had lost a lot of people So now with this, it definitely exacerbates a situation that without a doubt, probably, not probably, the odds are many, many are leaving. If you have no job, well, even my hairdresser has told me we are leaving. Her husband is an air conditioning technician. And there's no job. They said, we can't pay our rent. She was able to tell me. So without a doubt, Todd, we're going to be losing a large, large part of a population. And that is very, very sad. But those who can will stay. Those who can will stay.
Well, Joan Figueroa, we're so glad that you and Nadir, your husband, are doing well. Sorry you had to flee your home in Puerto Rico, but glad that you're doing well in New York and also glad that you plan to return. So thank you for joining us to talk to us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Fighters from the Syrian Democratic Forces celebrated yesterday in the streets of Raqqa, the de facto capital of the ISIS terrorist group since 2014. As of Tuesday, most of that city is under the control of U.S.-backed Syrian forces. A handful of ISIS fighters remain. U.S. Army Colonel and spokesman Ryan Dillon had this to say yesterday about ISIS.
We have devastated their networks, targeted and eliminated their leaders at all levels. We've degraded their ability to finance their operations. Their flow of foreign recruits has gone from about 1,500 fighters a month down to near zero today. Now, in ISIS's so-called capital in Raqqa, we see the terrorist group on the verge of a devastating defeat at the hands of our Syrian Democratic Force partners.
Victory has come at a high cost. Much of Raqqa has been destroyed, with over 1,000 civilians killed in American-led airstrikes and 270,000 residents displaced. And pushing ISIS out of Raqqa does not mean the brutal terror group is defeated. With more is Rukmini Callimachi, correspondent covering ISIS for our partner, The New York Times. Rukmini, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Todd.
How big of a victory is this for anti-ISIS forces in Raqqa?
I would say, and combined with the loss of Mosul, the loss of Raqqa is a big deal. It's a symbolic hit to the Islamic State. This is their de facto capital. It was also the seat of the foreign fighters, the American, Canadian, European, you know, fighters who joined this group. The majority of them seemed to flock to Raqqa. And finally, it was the locus of their external operations, in the sense that this is where the foreign fighters that ended up going back to Europe to attack were trained and originally came from. So yes, it's a big deal. But on the flip side of that, Todd, you'll never hear me say that this is the end of ISIS.
So more than a moral victory in Raqqa, but what's to prevent ISIS from simply relocating all of these functions that you just described, being able to import and export fighters, finance, and all the rest of it?
That's exactly it. And as we know, in fact, they already have. So as of last year, in 2016, I wrote a story with my colleague Eric Schmidt. And as of that point in time, so over a year ago, officials in the intelligence community were telling us that ISIS had already relocated hundreds of fighters to the European Union and hundreds more to Turkey. And Turkey is the piece of this puzzle that people rarely talk about and often forget about. Turkey is ostensibly a NATO ally, but we've had very little impact on how that country carries out the war on ISIS. And in fact, we know that ISIS fighters have been able to go in and out of Turkey with some level of impunity, and they've also been able to create safe houses and bases for themselves. Just recently, a major airline plot was dismantled in Australia, where a person was trying to carry a bomb onto a plane, and we learned that the components for the explosive that were in that bomb had actually been shipped from an ISIS member in Turkey.
So ISIS fighters spread to Turkey, to Europe, and that's not necessarily new. But when we look back at Syria and Iraq, Rukmini, what does losing territory mean to ISIS? So many times in the past with terrorist organizations, we've seen them shift tactics and become insurgency groups again, melting into the towns and into the cities and simply shifting away from military confrontation.
For sure. But before we even touch on that, let's not forget that the caliphate is still not over. So just in Iraq and Syria, ISIS still holds around 10,000 square kilometers of land. That's roughly 4,000 square miles. That's almost the size of Connecticut. So that's still a significant piece of land. But yes, of course, this is a group that began as an insurgency. It was an insurgency just a couple of years ago. So they have surely not forgotten how to be insurgents. The main thing that they are losing by losing all of this territory is the enormous amount of money that they were able to make from taxing the population under their control and from mining the resources in that area, whether it was agriculture or oil.
Rukmini, are there still communities, though, in Syria and Iraq ready to accommodate or at least tolerate ISIS fighters, if not ruling their towns and taxing them, sort of blending into the regular population?
I think for sure. When I was in Mosul, I spent 2 months in Mosul this summer, and I was there the day that the city fell. And weeks after, literally months after even, I would be going through the east or the western part of the city. I would stop in to a police station or to a military base to interview a commander, and I would find out that just that morning they had picked up another ISIS fighter who was hiding in this person's house or who was being harbored by this particular family. So to be sure, this is something that's uncomfortable to talk about, but there are communities among Sunnis in that area that do believe in their ideology and that still support them.
And that's going to be a major thing to reckon with going forward, isn't it? I mean, if fighters want to melt into towns and towns are overall sympathetic, rooting those fighters out becomes extremely difficult.
It becomes extremely difficult, and it gets complicated when the way in which the governing power behaves is not always on the up and up. So already we're seeing accusations of torture, of mistreatment by the Shia militias. In recent weeks, we've seen large numbers of ISIS fighters, around 1,000 in the town of Hawija in Iraq, and around 500 in the town of Tal Afar, also in Iraq. These are two towns that fell after Mosul, but before Raqqa. These 1,500 fighters basically turned themselves in to the Peshmerga troops. These are Kurdish troops within Iraq. And what we learned after they turned themselves in is that they had instructions from their ISIS emirs to not turn themselves in to the Shia militias because they knew that those people would either kill them or hurt them.
Well, Rukmini, you describe Mosul and Raqqa and a lot of smaller towns that have been liberated from ISIS. Yeah. Many of them are almost completely destroyed. What does reconstruction look like? Is it even possible right now?
That's a really important point, Todd. So one of the questions that I've had throughout this process is, yes, we've removed Raqqa, we've removed Mosul from ISIS's grasp, but at what cost? I was in Western Mosul on the day that the city was declared liberated. There were celebrations that rang out really across the world, from the White House to the fighters who were in the city. And I couldn't help but think, as I was walking through the completely destroyed streets of the old city, that this might be a town, at least the western part of it, that may never come back. It looked like the streets that I saw in Haiti after the catastrophic earthquake a couple of years ago.
Rukmini Callimachi, covering ISIS for the New York Times. Rukmini, always great to have you.
Thank you, Todd.
Let's leave the present behind for a moment, shall we, and jump 50 years into the future. Welcome to 2067. As part of our ongoing series, Imagining the Year 2067, we asked science fiction writers to give us a glimpse into their versions of the future. Stanley Bing has written several satirical books about business and has had a humor column in Fortune magazine for decades. But he turned to the future for his next book called Immortal Life. It comes out in December. And Bing looked no further than the palm of his own hand to imagine what life might be like 50 years from now.
This whole thing we have now of everybody sitting around with their noses on their screens, it's not sustainable. So what you're going to have are people who are walking around with their communications hardware implanted. I suggest that it's in your mastoid bone, which is conveniently located next to your brain and right behind your ear. That interface will handle incoming and outgoing communications, you know, with other people, referring to the internet and the cloud, which will be omnipresent. The cloud will be omnipresent in people's lives. They'll constantly be referring to a mass brain, the way that bees refer to each other. The reliance on digital input that people are now experiencing will lead to, I think, the inability to generate independent thought. You can see it now. If you strip the phones away from people, they enter a kind of a fugue state where they kind of just sit and mull. And then they get really uncomfortable, and then they find some reason to get up and go. The genetic implications of that for me would mean that, you know, our brains will evolve in such a way that the part of the brain that's dedicated to thinking will shrink. And the part of the brain that's dedicated to sending and receiving communications from the cloud and from other people will grow. So you'll have people that are excellent at constantly staying in touch with the mass brain, but incapable of thinking. In my book, Immortal Life, I talk a lot about the concentration of ownership that we're seeing now. You know, I sort of predict that 50 years from now, we'll probably have one big company. And that company owns the cloud. So the relationship between the means of production and distribution and the control of people through their digital sensibilities, their digital implants, that's all one ecosystem. The company controls the cloud controls people. Once you have cranial implants and you have information flowing back and forth from people's brains into computers, it's not a far leap to think that understanding of the brain and of consciousness will make possible a kind of porting from your brain into a mainframe. And from there, down again, into some receptacle that is younger, better looking, and still has all its hair. I mean, it's taken as a given now that this culture of sharing everything and this building of the hive brain is all a good thing. I think that the champion of tomorrow may be somebody who isn't born yet, and we'll look at all of the things that have assembled to make us less human and resist that.
Stanley Bing's newest book, The Immortal Life, comes out in December. You can check out our full series on the future 50 years from now at thetakeaway.org/2067. It's been 18 days since Stephen Paddock killed 58 people and injured hundreds more attending a country music festival in Las Vegas. And the public is no closer to knowing how he planned the massacre or why he did it. Meanwhile, three times Las Vegas police have changed the timeline of the events from the night of the shooting. Jennifer Medina is national correspondent for The New York Times, and she joins me from Los Angeles now to help explain what we still don't know and why it's been so hard to get answers.
We know very little about how he planned and essentially nothing about his motive. We know that he had to have done a tremendous amount of planning to get the number of guns. There were roughly 24 semi-automatic weapons found in his hotel room and more at his home near Las Vegas, and hundreds of rounds of ammunition. So he certainly had to do some planning and some level of practice, but we really don't know anything about that yet. And one of the most vexing things for investigators here has been this question of motive. There's no manifesto and no clear reason of why he did what he did.
I mean, this utter secrecy that you're describing and that authorities are describing seems extraordinarily unusual for somebody planning something so catastrophic.
That's right. In almost every other mass shooting incident, anything even approaching the scale, and this was an extremely large scale, remember, this is nearly 60 people who were killed, you've had some sort of letter or something written on the internet. In the case of Orlando, you had the perpetrator on the phone with negotiators saying what he wanted and what he was thinking. We have nothing like that in this case, which is very unusual.
So there have been discrepancies from the night of the shooting when police intervened and descended on the Mandalay Bay Hotel. What can you tell us about the differences in timeline from different authorities involved and how those are starting to align?
At the moment, it seems like everybody is essentially in agreement of what happened, but this has really come out in a piecemeal fashion and changed at several different times. Now, Sheriff Joe Lombardo, who is the head of the Las Vegas Police Department, has said, even at the start, has said, look, we've got tons of information to sort through, many pieces of evidence, many people to talk to. Things are going to change throughout. And that's fairly typical throughout any sort of big investigation like this. What's different here is sort of how significantly the times have changed and how many times. Initially, the reports were that the shooting started around 10:05 and that a security guard was shot after the shooting had ended on the music grounds about 10 minutes later. The sheriff later said last week that, in fact, the security guard had been shot first, several minutes before the shooting had started at the music venue.
Yes, the timeline associated with the original shot and Mr. Campos has changed. What we have learned is Mr. Campos was encountered by the suspect prior to his shooting to the outside world.
Then late in the week, he said, no, I'm sorry, we had it wrong. We had wrong information. And in fact, it happened roughly at the same time.
Mr. Campos received his wounds in close proximity to 2205.
In between that, MGM, which owns the Mandalay Bay where the shooting happened, said, look, we think that the information that the police are putting out is wrong. We're cooperating with police, but we want you to know that we think the information is wrong, which is a fairly extraordinary thing for a private company to say, to sort of publicly contradict investigators on something like this.
And Jennifer, on the police side, there are questions of why it took the cops 12 minutes to locate Stephen Paddock in the big hotel when they were already there. What do we know about that?
It's quite confusing, I think, for the general public and people, and as the vast majority of people haven't been in this sort of situation before. 12 minutes to us sounds like an extremely long time. The case that the police have made repeatedly is, in fact, 12 minutes is very fast, given what they had to do. They apparently climbed 32 flights of stairs to get to the floor. It's not exactly clear why they climbed stairs instead of taking the elevator. They couldn't get onto the floor because Paddock had apparently barricaded one of the stairwells. And they also believe that there were multiple gunmen perhaps shooting from multiple floors. So they responded. There was a team of about 8 officers at the scene. They go up to the floor, and by the time they get to the floor, the shooting has stopped. They then no longer act as if it's an active shooter. They consider that something different because the shooting has stopped and start to clear the floor, evacuate the floor. So the question for the general public has been, well, did they do everything fast enough? And the sheriff has been extremely clear that he thinks that not only did they do this fast enough, but they did it as fast as possible, and they, in fact, saved lives.
Okay, the officers and the first strike team reached this 32nd floor within 12 minutes, which is phenomenal. And keep in mind, this delay was not undue. It was purposeful, and no shots were being heard by the suspect at this point.
I think it's really will be investigated and debated and examined by experts to see what they did and what they could have done differently, and can anybody learn something from this?
So, Jennifer Medina, as the police continue to look and continue to investigate Stephen Paddock, his planning, his possible motives, with all of the unanswered questions, where are they looking now?
They have said that they've got 2,000 leads and hundreds of interviews and thousands of pieces of evidence. They have all kinds of tape. You know, Las Vegas is one of the most monitored places in the world, so they have all kinds of tapes from casinos and other places watching him go in and out. They've spoken with his girlfriend, who remains cooperative in the investigation and apparently certainly not named as a suspect and apparently does not seem to know much about the attack that we know of, and really trying to reconstruct his whole life and psychologically, professionally, financially, all of those things. So it's hard to know, though, if we will ever really know a motive. As one person put it, the only way we'll know is if we get inside his head, and we can't do that because he's killed himself.
Jennifer Medina with the New York Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. The NFL has announced it will not force players to stand for the national anthem before league games. That news broke as a group of NFL owners met with players and Commissioner Roger Goodell in New York. The meeting was set to discuss the national anthem controversy, as well as police brutality and social conditions that some players have been protesting. Goodell said the meetings were
very productive and very important. It reflected, I think, our commitment to work together with our players on issues of social justice.
Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Dave, did any specific agreements come out of the meeting that you've been talking to players about, aside from the announcement that they don't necessarily break any rules if they don't stand for the national anthem?
They went in there because they wanted a firm agreement that any First Amendment rights would not be broached. That was a big starting point for them. So just getting that on the table was seen as a victory for the players. Secondarily, some players, like Doug Baldwin of the Seattle Seahawks, emerged from the meeting saying that they had received a financial commitment from NFL owners regarding very specific sports and social justice work that players were doing. And I'm trying to confirm whether other owners and other cities have made that commitment as well. And lastly, before the meeting even started, you had a letter that was signed by Roger Goodell and Doug Baldwin that was sent to leading members of Congress supporting a bill that's on the House and Senate floor dealing with mandatory minimums. So all in all, I mean, it's so interesting, Todd, because you asked about my reporting. The players who feel like the owners were there in good faith to talk about this feel very positive about the meeting. The players who think that the owners are only setting this up as a kind of kabuki theater to put the anthem stuff in the rear view of the NFL, I mean, they're the ones who are a little more skeptical.
Meanwhile, another part of this story continues, Dave Zirin, because Colin Kaepernick, the quarterback, was not at this meeting. Is that right?
That is correct. He was not at this meeting. Now, let me give the details about that. He was not invited by the National Football League, and their spokesperson, Joe Lockhart, spokesperson for Roger Goodell, said before the meeting that he did not even understand why Colin Kaepernick would even be invited to this meeting. I mean, and a lot of folks read this as connected to the fact that he can't get a job in the league, this idea of erasing his presence from these conversations.
Well, Dave, let me just stop you, because in the minute we have left, I want to make sure we cover Kaepernick's grievance against the NFL.
Yes.
He's basically filing with the NFL saying owners are colluding to not give him a job. Where does that stand?
Yes. Right now, it's very interesting. The latest developments are that Colin Kaepernick has enlisted the NFL Players Association and their attorney, Jeffrey Kessler, who's an absolute shark on these issues. He's taken on the NCAA and several other very high profile cases involving unions and sports. The other part about this that's really important to keep our eye on and what's going to make this particularly explosive is that my sources tell me that they are going to pursue the connection between NFL owners and Donald Trump and the idea that NFL owners are actually taking orders from Donald Trump to punish Colin Kaepernick. And Trump has, of course, bragged about this in speeches. So, I mean, a lot of this proof is out there in the public sphere. And that's going to be a very interesting approach because, remember, this is a grievance, not a lawsuit. And this does go outside the bounds of what the collective bargaining agreement defines as collusion. But speaking to Kaepernick's legal team, they think they can make it work.
Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Thanks again, Dave.
Thanks so much, Todd. Really appreciate being on the show.
Thanks for joining us here on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. All this week on the show, we've heard from hundreds of women, listeners, with your stories of enduring sexual harassment or assault.
The first time I can remember this happening, I was leaving a soccer game in Miami, Florida. The crowds were letting out. It was very crowded, and somebody stuck their hand up my skirt. I was 13 years old.
In 1978, I worked in a Greek fast food hamburger joint. The owner would constantly corner us in the walk-in refrigerator and wouldn't let us out until we gave him a kiss.
I'm not comfortable leaving my name, but I'm calling from New York, and I was raped, and nobody believed me, and I just never reported it to the police, and it was a hard time when I was a very young girl at the age of 17.
Women's experiences pouring out after news of years of abuse by Harvey Weinstein, and before him, Roger Ailes, and before him, Bill O'Reilly, and the list goes on. But our next guest says it's not women, but men who should confront systemic sexual harassment and predatory behavior.
If we want to prevent sexual harassment, sexual assault, domestic violence, relationship abuse, and that whole range of issues, we have to really focus on the perpetrators and the society that's producing them.
That's Jackson Katz, co-founder of Mentors in Violence Prevention and author of The Macho Paradox. Katz argues that thinking and talking about domestic violence, sexual abuse, and harassment as women's issues misses a critical point, that the perpetrators usually are men and that men need to influence their peers to change.
The challenge is to move beyond thinking about, okay, we're going to punish this new, you know, this perpetrator who's now emerged, and we're going to figure out if we can prosecute, if we can hold this person accountable, and then we move on until the next scandal happens, as opposed to thinking about how can we systematically embed, you know, prevention programming and sensibility in, you know, K through 12 education, in colleges and universities, in the military, in the workplace, in politics, business, everywhere.
Well, Jackson, you talk about how pervasive this problem is, and it gets even more basic. I mean, you talk about the language that we use when we talk about sexual harassment and sexual assault in the first place. Describe that.
Yeah, well, so often the very way we think and talk about these subjects keeps us in the old paradigm, what I refer to as the old paradigm of seeing these issues as women's issues that good men help out with. There's so much about the language that we use to talk about this subject that keeps us in the old paradigm. So, for example, the use of the passive voice, which is pervasive in discussions about gender violence. So we talk about how many women were raped last year rather than how many men raped women. Or we talk about how many girls were sexually harassed last year in a school district rather than how many boys sexually harassed girls or how many girls sexually harassed girls. We talk about how many teenage girls got pregnant last year rather than how many men and boys impregnated teenage girls. Even the term violence against women is a passive construction. There's no active agent in the sentence. It's almost like a bad thing that happens to women, violence against them, but nobody's doing it to them because there's no active agent in the sentence. So the very language that we use structures our way of thinking about these subjects that keeps our attention off of the, honestly, the group with more power. And that's how power functions, by shifting, in this case, by shifting accountability off of itself. So part of the political act that has to happen is rethinking the way that we're, the very way that we're thinking, and using language to keep us in the old paradigm.
And in your view, that shift of language can represent a shift of thinking or a shift of reference when it comes to sexual abuse.
Yes, and it shines the spotlight. If you turn the spotlight around onto men, and you, instead of saying violence against women, you say men's violence against women, or saying, instead of saying how many women were raped, you say how many men raped women. While, by the way, while it's not a perfect one-to-one ratio, people will point out that, you know, the average rapist rapes many more than one victim, so it's not a one-to-one ratio. At the same time, by shifting the focus of the language, it puts the accountability back where it belongs, and then the subsequent discussions about the solutions don't entail victim-blaming solutions like tell women to dress more conservatively or don't drink as much at a party or all the kinds of ways that we blame women for what men do to them. Part of the reason why we do that is the language guides us towards thinking about the women and her issues and her decisions, rather than turning it around where it should be on the men, and not just the men individually, but the culture that produces those men. Because ultimately, the most productive discussions that we could have in our society about reducing sexual violence and domestic violence and harassment is not about individual perpetration. It's about social norms. It's about institutional practices. It's about what is considered acceptable and normative in male culture for men to, how do men and women to act, the role that media plays in that, the role that other institutions play in perpetuating certain kinds of norms. All of this requires a level of both personal and institutional and societal introspection that is difficult. And as a result, I think people are more likely to and more inclined to blame the victims, talk about the women and girls, and not and even engage in a discussion like we're having right now about men and boys and the culture that produces them.
Jackson, you're calling for a real cultural shift in the way that men think about, approach, and talk to each other about sexual abuse and assault. I'm going to guess that you've gotten some pretty negative reaction and some abuse yourself for speaking out about this.
Well, I have to say, Todd, we've been working right in the heart of male culture for a long time. And yes, there is some pushback, but I'd say more likely guys will come into these discussions with their arms folded and a little bit skeptical, like, what are we going to hear? Yet another session of, you know, male bashing, or being told about how bad we are, or what the rules are that we're not following. They don't leave with that. I think you can talk empathetically with men. You can talk honestly with men. You can get men to have open dialogues about their experiences of being often policed into conformist silence with behavior that they don't like. A lot of men go along with behavior that they don't like within male culture, not because they're necessarily supportive of that behavior, but because they make decisions consciously or unconsciously that the costs to them, if they speak up within their peer culture, within their friendship circles, in their workplaces, those costs might be, you know, higher than they're willing to pay. And they themselves aren't willing to take the leadership to take the risk of standing up and speaking out. And when they hear other men saying, okay, it's time that we speak up, and when they hear, whether it's facilitators in a workshop or their colleagues or men in the public space, the more that they hear men talking about this and standing up about and standing with women as their allies and partners, and the more men can realize that this is not about bashing men. It's about pushing men and encouraging men to rise to the highest level of their aspirations for themselves. Because most men want to see themselves as good people who speak up in the face of injustice. They want to see themselves as somebody who, when they see something wrong, they see somebody being mistreated, that they're going to be somebody who will step up. But I think they need support and encouragement, because there are so many powerful forces in male culture that keep them silent.
That's Jackson Katz, co-founder of Mentors in Violence Prevention. Jackson, we appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me on, Todd.
This is Steve from the Lower East Side. For men to stop sexual assault, they have to stop joking about it. They have to stop accusing that the accused didn't do it because he's such a nice guy. And most importantly, they have to stop doing it.
This is Ken Ebert from Albany, New York. I believe that one thing we can do is men must be open to understanding that sexual harassment and assault does occur, and accept the role that we play in this. Second, we must learn what of our behavior constitutes harassment and be willing to change. And finally, we need to work to empower women wherever we can.
What role do you think men should play? We've been asking you all this hour. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can join the conversation, as always, on our Facebook page and visit our website at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.